October 20th, 2004. The first episode of the Bat Segundo Show is uploaded to the internet, starting off as a flimsy pretext for our young roving correspondent to interview the author David Mitchell. The interview is a rousing success. Literary geeks across the internet celebrate this unexpected coup against the mainstream media. Our young roving correspondent asks some interesting questions of David Mitchell. He's still a little green, but he makes the mistake of failing to call him David. Nevertheless, Mr. Mitchell, if we might be permitted to make the same mistake twice, is a generous guest, reading from his diary, and quite adept at talking through the telephone. A literary podcast, heralded as a new form of Camelot, is unleashed for the listening enjoyment of iPod listeners around the world.
Thank God Almighty, we are free at last!
September 14th, 2005, Episode 9. Our young roving correspondent talks with Bret Easton Ellis about a variety of things. He's in a locked room and he realizes that Mr. Ellis might kill him if he needed to. Nevertheless, the two men talk and no one comes out of that unscathed, or rather, not injured.
I do not shrink from this responsibility.
October 28th, 2005, episode number 11. The Bat Segundo Show features its first guest with multiple guests, getting Layla Lalami, Scott Esposito, Beth Waddle, and the fantastic Tito Perez into the same room. The Bat Segundo Show crew learns a little bit of engineering in the process. Mr. Segundo himself is quite pleased, but it is here that things take a turn for the worse. December 1st, 2005, episode number 15 with Octavia Butler is uploaded to the internet, but Mr. Segundo cannot be found. It's been suggested by several reliable conspiracy theorists that Mr. Segundo has disappeared from the face of the earth. He can't be found in his hotel room, and there's some disturbing ties between Bat Segundo's checking account, the CIA, Al-Qaeda, and Harold Oswald, who is Lee Harvey Oswald's third cousin, second removed. Further investigation reveals a magic bottle. Now, this bottle has made its way through several orifices and touched a lot of saliva, but shortly before Mr. Segundo headed to the beaches of Cabo San Lucas, the magic bottle is unearthed behind the motel clerk's front desk. It is confirmed by Jim Garrison that this magic bottle was, in fact, a flask of wild turkey that was consumed by one Jack Ruby, who not only assassinated Lee Harvey Oswald, but is known to have been in cahoots with the mob and the John Birch Society. Jack Ruby died of pneumonia on January 3rd, 1967, which was roughly the same time in which Robert Hoover, one of the great literary postmodernists, got his start as a writer. I mean, can you even begin to see the connections? I mean, I'm a little concerned because I can't get in touch with Bat Segundo anymore. I mean, he's nowhere to be found. And the evidence keeps on stacking up against him. I mean, cashier's check receipts, strange men with pork pie hats, and introductory guests named Jorge. I don't know what to do. I mean, they're all colluding to take this show down, and the paper trail leads right directly to Donald Rumsfeld, Shirley Bassey, and quite possibly Elizabeth Skernick, who is a secret operative with the National Security Agency. I mean, do you begin to understand my neuroses? Well, anyway, enough of all this. Mr. Segundo, I'm sure, will show up eventually. In the meantime, enjoy our young roving correspondent's interview with, who is it this week? Oh, yes, Amy Bender. I am here with Amy Bender, and we've been playing sort of email tag now for 3 months.
Yeah, it has been a little while.
I'm glad you were able to make it up here. So, I wanted to talk first about a theme that I notice in your stories. We'll get to Willful Creatures and all that later, but you have a certain sort of theme of precision that I've noticed. You have, like, in Off, for example, you have the woman who has to kiss a blonde-haired man, a black-haired man, and a dark-haired man. And then you also have, in Job's Jobs, the protagonist is given very specific sort of things. So you have this precision, and it's framed within this sort of absurdity. There's this, like, sort of logical kind of structure to it. And I was wondering, it reminded me very much of Flann O'Brien and the Bicycle Men. And since the third policeman is now the hip sort of thing because it's been in the episode of Lost, I was wondering, did you hear about this?
No.
Yes, it's it appeared briefly in an episode of Lost, and now they're claiming that if you read the book, that you will get the meaning to the television show.
And Dalkey has actually been, you know, it's gone through several printings, thanks to Flann O'Brien's making a comeback. But I wanted to find out where this attention to precision sort of came from, or whether Flann O'Brien was an influence of any kind, or, you know, what are your influences?
Well, it's a great question, because I'm aware of it in terms of the way I kind of pattern a story. And I actually haven't read The Third Policeman, but it's been recommended to me so many times that I really have to. It's high on the
list.
Have
you read any Flann O'Brien?
I've just read tiny bits of things, but I haven't really read him much at all. But
channeling the same sort of brain there.
Well, thank you. I mean, I really have heard from such reliable people that I would like him, and he feels like part of that kind of group of surrealist writers that I like. And there's a museum in LA, the Museum of Jurassic Technology, which is this, you know, odd museum. They have a great mini bookstore. It has about 10 fiction books, one of which is The Third Policeman. So based on that alone, I should have gotten it at that minute and read it. But I think that in terms of the precision, there's something that seems to help me if there's almost like a logical setup that then I can follow and play out, and usually it goes awry. So there's got to be something in a kind of setup where I can see, it helps me with plot, I think. I can see how the story's going to develop. If she has to kiss these three men, then she has to kiss these three men, and then what's going to happen? And then it kind of sets up a certain framework for me. So I think it appeals to some kind of logic in my brain. And sometimes when I teach, I'll talk about the words magic and logic because, for one, they look nice side by side because they share three letters, but also because magic is so dependent on logic. So as soon as you twist the world a little bit, you're also, I think, very indebted to the logic of whatever scenario it is. So if it's going to be a slightly, if God is going to come down and tell the writer he can't write anymore, it's got to follow that logic, like in Job's Jobs. And that's what I like when I'm reading some other writer that's kind of twisting reality. I like to feel like I can enter the world and the logic will hold.
Yeah.
So they feel very connected to me.
Well, you know, even if you look at sort of Monty Python, for example.
Yeah.
Every single sketch, I think, holds up because there is an underlining, you know, set of rules for this absurd world. Would you say that for each particular story that you have, you sort of go out of your way to create these rules for the given sort of situation? Or
I think it's more like it's a natural leaning to how I think or how I think about story writing. And so then I'll try a bunch of different openings, and then most of them won't progress. And the ones that do progress have kind of enough beneath the logic for me to explore. So I think I won't know the rules in advance. But, I mean, just going back to the story Off, I did know that she had that goal at that with that party.
Yeah.
And that I knew that she was probably not going to fulfill the goal, but I didn't know maybe she would. But that there was something so fixed about that goal that it seemed like highly likely that it would go awry.
Now, I have to ask you, was Off a sequel to Call My Name?
Yes.
I thought so, because they were both daughters of the millionaire.
Exactly.
Caught that. So.
And it's really nice when people catch that, because it feels like it, you know, I didn't, she's unnamed still, so I can't really make it explicit via names, but it feels like the same voice. I get the same sense of fun out of writing from that character's point of view.
Except this time she's being a little bit more social.
She's more social. She's a little meaner. Someone was saying that too, where they
maybe
said,
she learned
a
lesson from the last story. Right. I don't know.
Right. She's gotten a little beaten down. I think there's something. She's a little harsher to the people around her because I guess she's at a party and the other one it's just more isolated.
Yes. I want to talk about the story Debbie Land.
Okay.
What was interesting to me about this is that this was sort of a bit of a departure from you in the sense that the sort of, you know, weird perspective was shifted to the actual style of the piece as opposed to the content, your use of the first person plural in that. And I'm wondering, there's also, beyond the protagonist's inability to sort of escape the past, there seemed to me this almost this multiple personality disorder implication that I kind of picked up on.
That's true.
And I'm wondering how this story came to be. And I know it was written for The Black Clock, so I'm wondering if it was written specifically for that, or where did this come from? It seemed a very sort of different story from you.
Ah, it's interesting to hear. And Black Clock, Steve Erickson, the editor there, had asked me for a story, which was really nice of him, but it was this, I gave him two, and that was one of them, and he said, oh, how about this one? It's kind of with its Lord of the Flies-like feel to it, which I liked hearing. And I think I had written it, I'd written the first paragraph and sat with that first paragraph for a while, which is about the skirt that Debbie wears. And it was actually, and that part is in third person, and then the kind of entrance of the wee voice came later, when I think I just, I'd sort of seen, I think I'd read some Jeffrey Eugenides, because he's got Virgin Suicides all in first person plural. It seemed so fun. And often that'll be the way I kind of work with writing, is I'll think, oh, I want to try that. And so I wanted to try it, but it ended up being this very vicious we.
Yeah.
And a kind of multiple personality disorder, which is that it's actually not a we. It's really an I who was once a we. Because it's really, I think, at a certain point, it's clear that she's talking about herself as if she's a group because she's so identified with that kind of high school stage.
But I almost got the sense that there were two senses of her, though. The one left trapped in the past, one operating in the present, and together they sort of, you know, became I. At least that's what I got from it.
Oh, I think that's great, yeah. Actually, that the we would be those different parts, the two I's.
Yes.
Different parts of her life in terms of time. Which
and
feels
the two I's, there's a pun there for you.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And what I like about you saying that is it feels like there is truth to that, which is that we are kind of walking around then with a we happening, which is, I feel like, very different than the me that was in high school or the me that was a child, but it's still the same person, and yet you're kind of accumulating a different sense of yourself as you go.
Truly the royal we there.
Right, it's true. The royal we is handy. Actually, sometimes when I'm grading papers, I often will say, we need to know more about this character, and I'll wonder, why am I saying we? But it's sort of like the reader, we.
You want to frighten them. Oh. You're actually taking these papers up to the administration.
Exactly. We read this. We think you need more
characterization. We're circulating this through the higher echelons. While we're on the topic of these stories, I have to ask you this question,
sure.
too. Motherfucker.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
How did this have any problems making the rounds for the literary magazine? I can't imagine some particular journals not accepting a story with the title Motherfucker.
You know, it's been fine. I've actually, it's just been radio a little bit has been an issue because sometimes I'll do like a little radio interview with book and people have said, well, we can only refer to it as the character who likes to have sex with mothers.
You like and, Princess Sexy MF, you know?
Right, exactly. And so in terms of circulating it to places, it was fine. I mean, that was a piece too that was in a journal called Fence, and I think any of the literary journals would be fine, and I think even... I don't think that one got sent to some of the bigger places because I wanted to send it actually to Fence. But I wonder if they would have. I hope not. You know,
yeah.
I would think actually with magazines it would be okay. All the magazines that publish short stories are willing to say
New
fuck.
New Yorker would put like the asterisks in
right,
there. You know?
Exactly. I mean, I wonder. But there's a lot of swearing in there.
Yeah.
So
there is.
Yeah.
But also you also play with the notion of motherfucker, the
right.
word. And I
right.
like that immensely. It's also very similar to, well, since we can say this, since this is a podcast, it's very similar to cocksucker. Why is this
right.
a pejorative? You
right.
know? Why do we make some sort of sexual inclination? You almost humble the word with this story.
Oh,
you know,
thank
which
you.
I particularly enjoy.
And it's a really fun word. Like, I think it was fun to kind of think about what does the word mean and what's it about and why is it such a big, you know, beefy swear word, you know,
yeah.
it's one that's got a lot of punch to
well,
it.
That's one of the seven words of George Carlin. You
right,
know?
And actually, I'm curious about the seven because he was talking on the radio and I was trying to think, what are the seven? And he wouldn't say them on the, or he couldn't say them on the radio.
He couldn't.
So I've got to just get his,
I
you
think
know.
They're, okay, well.
Can we go
I think
over
it's
them?
Fuck shit, motherfucker, cocksucker. there's three we're missing.
Because it seems like they're a lot. I'm surprised that
probably,
it's only seven.
Probably,
yeah, it's got to be.
So there's five. So I don't know what the other two are, but. That's pretty good. I mean,
that's five. That was
that's
good.
That's five of the seven.
And right, maybe that's the...
Because they always bleep them out when he says them on TV. So.
Right.
I think in
right.
one of the Carlin films, he actually says them all. But
he must.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
he has to.
Yeah,
I think it's part of the routine in a way. But yeah, so it's one of the seven. And yeah, to think about the idea of fucking mothers and what that might mean and
yeah.
and why are mothers appealing and, you know, what about this character finds them interesting.
Well, it's almost Oedipal, too. Right,
right. Though I have a friend.
There's a very sort of, it's very quiet. It starts off as this sort of benign kind of recontextualization of the word, and then it becomes this sort of like, you know, weird Oedipal thing.
True, though. It's a friend of mine who's a therapist said, and I thought this was very funny, that she's like, well, you kind of resolve the Oedipal worry because he doesn't fuck married mothers. So I think there isn't
yeah,
a man in the
true.
Way to kind of want to steal the woman from, which I thought was just funny.
He truly is a motherfucker with a sense of honor.
Right, that he is just interested in the mothers, but it's okay if the guy's gone at that point. Like he has, right. He has a sense of some kind of integrity with the system he's put up.
Okay. Well, while we're on this subject, I want to talk about the streak of sexual perversion that is throughout your
all
work.
Right.
Motherfucker, which we have just mentioned,
yes.
and I think I've said fuck more in this podcast than any of the others.
I'm proud.
But, yes.
I'm proud of
but,
that.
But, you know, let's go through the list. We've got, you know, Quiet Please is Randy Librarian. We've got Where Do We Start with Fell This Girl.
Right, true,
you know?
True.
Ironhead, the Pumpkinhead Sex. These are a very interesting sort of perversion that runs throughout your work, and I was wondering if the realm of the fantastic sort of encourages these sort of impulses, or where are you indebted to perhaps the original savagery of the Grimm stories,
yes.
or you know where does this where would the origin of this be?
Well, it's I mean, the original savagery of the Grimm tales is, I think, part of where the violence and darkness comes in. But they tend not to be sexual, I think, because they often were told to kids. But I'm trying to think of anything where there's kind of a sexual feeling. Often what happens, though, in the Grimm tales is the daughter marries the father, the king, or that happens a lot in fairy tales. Mm-hmm. In a really disturbing way, where the king says, well, my wife's died, and she says, the first person that walks around the corner I should marry, and then his daughter walks around the corner, and he says, well, sorry, daughter, I guess I gotta marry you. And the daughter flees, horrified. So there is something, you know, strangely sexual and incestuous in that. But in terms of the origin of it, I guess I think it is paired with a certain surrealism, or the idea that it's another way to push metaphor, because it feels like if things happen physically, or there's a kind of push in the ways the characters are interacting through sex, it's also a way to explore the feelings in the same way that I think it is if a girl has a hand of fire, or like in Kafka, if he wakes up as a cockroach, then suddenly you can explore his relationship with the family in a way that you can't if Gregor is a man. And so I feel like the sexuality is not so dissimilar, because it's pushing something. Like, I was teaching Mary Gateskill's stories the other day, and my students were sort of like, oh, it's all this S&M and it's so shocking. But there was this one story, A Romantic Afternoon. God, I can't remember the third word. Anyway, that's terrible. But
I've been wanting to read Veronica.
Me too. And it's from Bad Behavior, and it's just this man who really wants to find a masochist, and the woman, he's like, keeps saying to her, you're really not a masochist. And she told him, well, I'm a masochist. And he's like, but you're not letting me burn you with my cigarette lighter.
Yeah.
And it's kind of funny, because he's so annoyed, and then they're kind of figuring out each other, and they had these expectations for each other, and my students were wrestling with it, and then it became clear, we were talking about how, is it that different than a person who says, I really want you to love the movie that I love. How come you don't love that movie? That's not an S&M scenario, but it's a basic relationship scenario, and that she's pushing it to this extreme that is maybe less familiar to people, and yet it's so familiar about trying to meet someone who matches you. Mm-hmm. The sadist wants the masochist wants the sadist, and here in the story, the sadist is like, but you're a sadist. Wait. We can't be a couple. Yeah. And so I feel like there's something in that, that she's really using sexuality as a kind of metaphor for the ways people interact. And it puts it out on this extreme so that she can explore it. And I really admire that in terms of thinking about how, what does a character reveal about herself or himself physically? And it actually makes it easier for me as the writer, because then it's like I can attend to the physical world of the story and reveal character that way.
So you're saying that some of these sort of so-called perversions, that's, of course, a question of debate depending upon each particular person.
That's true.
But these stem primarily from trying to sort of get the characters out and allowing them to sort of interact with the other characters. You'd say that's predominantly where these quirks are coming from.
I think sexuality is really interesting, because I think it does express something about a person, and it's fun to write about, it's fun to read about. But like in the librarian story, I feel like it's a character who's a librarian but who's also feeling intense loss. And so, okay, maybe I could make it more subtle about how she's dealing with her intense loss, but I didn't want to make it subtle. I wanted to make it really loud.
Yeah.
And what would be a way to make it really loud? That would be about trying to connect with people, but actually not connecting to people, but also being really aggressive in an interesting way. Like, all the stuff gets revealed about her through her taking the guys in the back room and being the librarian
now,
fantasy.
That story appeared in GQ, correct?
Yes.
Yes, I'm wondering how that came to be. Did GQ actually pursue that story, or did someone else submit it to GQ?
I think I had just gotten my agent, and he sent it to GQ, and they took it, which was so exciting, because I'd never been published in a magazine before. So they went for it, which was thrilling.
Yeah. So it's sort of a secret kind of Trojan horse into the men's magazines.
It's true. Exactly. Know? Exactly. Unpacking some female stuff. And I like reading stuff where there is a lot of sex in it. Like, I think because it's a subject that we don't talk about directly with each other that often, it's really fun to read about really explicitly, because that's one of the things literature can do in a different way than maybe film can do, because you're seeing it, but you're going to project a lot of thoughts into it, but the characters aren't going to be revealing their thoughts.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to be instead like a lovely, you know, montage of them rolling around. And to be able to with writing, go into the thoughts and the actions at the same time.
Well, speaking of thoughts, one thing that's interesting about your stories and also your novel is that you often do away with quote marks.
True.
Yeah, I'm wondering why that is. Is it sort of a way to kind of just go straight to the thought process, or perhaps the dialogue is up to sort of debate for sort of the deconstructionists.
I think, right, in a way, it sort of it folds it all into the narrative, where suddenly, often it's in first-person narratives, but not always, where it feels like maybe it's part of their thinking. Is it what's outside, what's inside? Gets a little blurrier. But on a purely superficial level, I like how it looks on the page. I physically like how it looks without quotes.
Have you considered using dashes before that? Or
I've never tried dashes, and I've been using quotes a little bit lately, and sometimes everything looks so spidery with all those quotes everywhere, all those little spider legs. But dashes look great, but it's just a very different feel, so I couldn't quite picture it with my own stuff.
Now, how visual of a writer would you say that you are, meaning in terms of layout and in terms of how the story, you know, looks? You were mentioning the spider legs.
Yeah. I think I'm very visual. I think that's part of what attracts me to words. One word versus another word is often how it looks, also how it sounds. But I think of Gertrude Stein a lot as being someone who I think is really interested in how words look. And I just like sometimes to look at a paragraph before I read it. I just like to look at the round letters and the tall letters and the long words and the short words. And it just feels really painted in that way.
Yeah.
So I really like how words look on the page, and it's immediately apparent to me when a writer doesn't care about how a word looks, because even if it sounds great, I won't feel that kind of, you know, back-scratching satisfaction of looking at the page and thinking, oh, that looks nice, you know.
Well, simultaneously, there's something to be said about, you know, you write in very simple language, and there's something that if you actually speak your stories, you say your stories orally, then it is something that is also, it seems to me that there's a conscious effort by you, not only from a visual standpoint, but also if, you know, it sort of helps you at readings, but also if people are reading these stories to friends or to lovers, then they can, you know, it's very, very easy to sort of read. Do you often read your stories when you write them, when they're just about done?
Or yeah, I will read them aloud to hear them. And I guess, because is it what you're saying, that then a visual picture comes to mind, or that they're easy to read because of the words are sort of simple choices?
Well,
often
they're easy to read on that sense, but on another sense, it's also you're dealing with two different sort of perceptions. Well, three if you count the actual act of just reading in your head. Now we're talking about like how it actually looks visually, how it is as it's spoken, and how it is as the mind sort of wraps itself around
meaning.
The sentences.
Yeah, exactly, yeah, so. Exactly. And I think those are the kind of three parts of what a word can do.
Yeah.
You know, you have sound, you have look, and you have content, and all three feel important. That's why word, like the SAT words, I feel like have always been distasteful to me, because they don't look good and they don't sound good. They mean something interesting and specific, but a word like pedagogy, which I didn't know what it was till I went to graduate school, is not, I think, a visually interesting word, and I don't like how it sounds. It's ugly, so I don't want to ever use it.
There's words like perfervid, which are very fun.
Very fun.
You know, or,
yeah, they can
even
be
demagogue
long.
Is a fun
demagogue
word.
Is a great
why.
Word. It is, but it's got a lot of resonance, so it's demagogue. Yeah, no,
yeah,
I think.
Mean, not only that, but also like the obscure words are great. Like if you
they
read
are.
Like a Gene Wolfe novel, for example, you're constantly hunting back to the dictionary. So there's something to be said. Have you ever considered sort of writing a story where it's completely, you know, like 10-cent words? Or
I mean, it would be a good challenge, actually. Or I think you're right to kind of look back at some words that I think have gotten left behind and resurrect them a little bit. I was thinking about the word wreck, R-E-C-K, the other day, in terms of recklessness and how, you know, how would
reckless,
I use the
feckless.
Word? Yeah, like how to use wreck when it's not reckless, like a sense to care, to wreck, but it's not with a W. It's just, so I think I like those words a lot too, and a kind of multi-syllabic word I'm all for, but it's interesting which ones, probably it goes back to like Latinate words versus other kinds of words, which ones I find more beautiful versus other ones. Like, you know, Welsh words are incredible, or words where you get all these Y's and...
Or any of the words in Chaucer, for that matter.
Yeah,
I mean,
Middle
fun.
English, it's incredible, it's beautiful.
Here for there.
Yeah. I like those a lot.
Okay. I noticed also that willful creatures like the girl with the flammable skirt, rather the girl in the flammable skirt, is actually divided into three parts.
Yes.
Now, I had read an interview in Piff that you had actually had loose titles for girl.
Yeah.
But somehow it went awry, and basically it ended up being 1, 2, 3. So I'm wondering if with this you actually made an effort to sort of get the themes back again. and it sort of fell asunder. I'm curious as to, are there any thematic components to these parts?
There are, though I didn't think of titling them this time because I think it felt good not to title them last time.
Yeah.
I did try and kind of group it in terms of thinking of the stories as a movement, what would be the movement. And so the kind of harsher stories are up front.
Mm-hmm.
So I think of it as like that's the mean group, and then the middle group is sort
death,
of
you know?
Right. It starts with death, and then there's a lot of kind of torture and you know, sadistic characters hurting each other in Debbie Land, and and then the middle group has sort of a little more conflict with that. So there's maybe moments of hope, but and then the last group has more of a sense of the more hopeful stories, I think, or little connections that actually happen, or moments where people feel more loss.
Okay. Okay. Now, I was going to ask you actually about this. There was an article, and this kind of ties into your work, but there's an article in today's New York Times in the magazine that actually announced a new critical movement called Literary Darwinism. I'm not sure if you've heard of this.
No.
I hadn't heard of it either until I read this article. Basically, it's attempting to recontextualize literature in terms of evolutionary biology, which is really, really odd. So now the Iliad is not just some sort of like male swagger, but it's all about sort of preserving the bloodline.
Wow.
Now the opening line of Pride and Prejudice, totally different meaning now, because it's all about like, you know, procreation and the survival, that kind of thing. What's interesting is that it's sort of like, you know, basically turning its back to on Derrida. And even Ian McEwan is actually contributing to this collection of essays about literary Darwinism. Mm. But I was curious, based off of this, what your thoughts might be on this, just sort of giving it to you right now. And second of all, do you feel that does fiction need to keep its eyes so obsessed on evolutionary biology? Do you sort of, are you concerned with biology as you write these stories in terms of like, you know, who is surviving and who is going to procreate? Well, we talked about that earlier.
Now, are they saying there's a progression, an evolutionary progression, or are they just saying all of it is reflecting some of our basic needs as humans as evolving?
It's kind of a catch-all category. Okay. On one level, it studies sort of, yes, there is sort of a natural evolution of thought within these particular books. So this is the gist of what I got in the article. But also, it's the study of how people sort of evolve and procreate and connect and that kind of thing. So it's an interesting sort of subject. Some people are kind of, you know, some people in the art claim it's going to be sort of, you know, kind of a fluke. Others say, you know, some professors even have just sort of like immediately switched completely to this.
Huh.
Yeah, so I don't know if it's the next thing or if it's just the pet rock right now of the intellectuals or something.
Exactly.
You know?
I mean, I guess it's hard to know that much about it at this point, but it seems like the same rules that apply to us as people, as evolutionary biological people, are going to show up in fiction because, but it's just a different lens on how to look at the characters. But so beyond that, I'm not really sure how it would affect a reading of something, because it would be saying the characters also have a drive to procreate, and so therefore some of the pressures that happen to the characters come from that drive.
Yeah, and from their drive for survival.
Right.
Too. Yeah.
But I think that's true of people anyway, and you know, it's. I think it's still going to, part of the fiction's job is to reflect the world back as we see it. And so then if I see that in people, then I'm going to try and write about it. So.
But when you're playing God, like, for example, your colleague at USC, Tom Boyle, likes to play God in a particularly sort of bitter way.
Yeah.
He really likes to play God. He can sometimes be quite cruel.
Yeah.
Where do you stand when you create these characters and sort of mesh them, you know, mesh their lives out and allow them to sort of run across the page?
I guess it feels like if I start to jump in and decide the character's fate, essentially, or decide the message about what the character's ending role is, then it can be kind of invasive. So I think part of my job is to sort of see where the story goes and try and let it go there and try and get out of the way of the story. And I do think when you end a story or you end a novel, then you set in place some kind of opinion. So it's like by the choice of where I end something is going to show bitterness or hope or belief in people or despair about people. I think that just is inevitable in whatever the ending is. And so some of that's going to be things that I believe are going to come across. But it's so complicated because I think some of my stories put across a much darker view of humanity than I feel. It's just a way to express the kind of dark part that maybe I don't express as much. Does that make sense with what you're saying?
It sort of does. Well, do you set any limits as to how far you will go on the page? And are those limits kind of expanding as you continue to write these stories? Or?
I don't set any conscious limits in terms of how far I'm going to go, in terms of what happens to them. Like, will they die or be tortured or whatever like that?
Be turned into pumpkin heads and have iron head offspring?
I think anything can happen. And it's like the quieter I am, the better, the more I can just let the things happen. And you know, sometimes I'll freak myself out and then I'll need to put something aside for a while because I won't want to continue with those characters because I don't like them. But often if the writing is kind of cooking along, then that's my job, is to keep going.
Okay. Okay. Now there's a part of you, I suspect, though, despite the fact that you deal in the outre, that actually, I think, is committed to a realist perspective.
True. That is true.
Quiet Please and Debbie Land both sort of come to mind on this. I'm wondering if you could ever consciously write a story that is completely devoid of anything sort of phantasmagorical, or if you've tried this. Mm. I mean, certainly, we mentioned Debbie Land earlier. But what are your thoughts on verisimilitude in your particular fiction?
I've tried it before, and it so far has not really worked for me, that it seems like if I try and be true to what I see the world as, it just gets kind of uptight. The writing itself gets kind of uptight, and that there's something that loosens up for me and tweaking it a little bit, and then I can actually relax and be more honest about what I see, and then the writing gets better. But it may change, too. Like, I think there's something freeing about thinking, well, maybe it'll get very realistic and maybe it won't, or maybe it'll get more out there. It's just going to go back and forth as I change, I think some of that will happen. But I do know that as a kid, I think there is an aesthetic that you are born with. A person does have an aesthetic that is part of them. And as a kid, I was really drawn to kind of dark, odd art of all kinds, paintings, theater, dance, music. Like, it just thrilled me in a really visceral way, and I think that's expanding. Like, it was only that for a long time, and I think it expands, so then I can come to appreciate, oh, look at this very classical ballet, I can appreciate it instead of the one where they're all running around in, you know, strange bat uniforms.
Yeah.
But if I had to pick, often I would pick the one that feels a little more in that aesthetic that I love, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like the Jane Austen thing or something, like appreciating things that I didn't know I would like. But, you know, do I feel when I read Kafka, like, just I feel some kind of visceral, you know, aha,
yeah,
I love this. That's part of who I am.
So is your voice then, would you say, sort of kind of a filter of all these things kind of meshing together? Is this what spawns Amy's imagination here?
I guess. I mean, it's so hard to know, but I think there is something about when I sit down thinking about Grimm's fairy tales again. Yeah. And I read so many fairy tales as a kid, and I just read them over and over and over, and I just loved how they were told, and I loved the content, and I still love them. Whenever I pick up a fairy tale, a part of me is happy. I just feel happy reading it. And so that's going to filter in. It's a major way that when I sit down to try and make something on my own, I think it is going to have aspects of that. And that what the hard thing is to remember what you love, I think, and remember the things that you look at and that feel kind of enlivening or something. That it took me a while to think, oh, fairy tales are an allowable form of literature instead of being just kiddie lit.
But, however, the more far out you go, the more work you're sort of setting up for yourself, because you have to make the situation plausible. And you have to, you know, or is plausibility even a factor?
Well, I think this is what I feel, and it goes back to the thing about sex, too, which is that I feel like I find it easier when the world is less plausible, because I'm so concerned with dealing with the physicality of the world I've set up. Like, you know, in writing classes, there's a lot of show, don't tell talk. There's a lot of, you know, deal with what room are they in? What does it smell like? And if it's a room that I've been in a million times, I'm more apt to not describe it because I know it. And I'm going to think that the reader knows it, even though they don't. But if it's a room that no one's been in before because I'm making it up supposedly from scratch, I'm forced to describe it and say, well, in this room, the walls are all made out of eggshells. And they've sewn the eggshells together with, like, little threads made out of, you know, eggshell, you know, knitting factories where they, you know, whatever. Suddenly I'm creating something, but what I'm forced to do then is let the reader in, and I get really physical and really concrete. But if it's a room where the walls are cement and the thing has insulation and all that, I'm going to skip all that detail. Not like you need to know that the walls are cement, but in that way it feels like it's easier writing to me. And sometimes it feels like, am I really allowed to just describe this world as I'm making it up? But in fact, I think that's allows a reader to experience it.
But at the same time, if the reader is, I mean, to play the devil's
advocate. Please, please.
If a reader is trying to sort of identify with, oh, say, like a boy who has keys for hands.
Yeah.
He'll look at his own fingers and go, hey, what the heck's going on here? I don't have keys for hands. Then it becomes difficult, perhaps, to sort of identify from a human's perspective to that character. Now, you know, this doesn't necessarily mean that they can't identify. I mean, you know, for example, like in that same story, there was like one of the things I thought was hilarious was the man reading How to Meet Girls, the book. And, you know, all he has to do is put the book down and actually go.
Right,
and that is a very sort of justifiable irony. But for me, anyway, I think my problem with that story, you know, I'll be point blank, was that, you know, I couldn't sort of access a boy with keys.
Yeah, okay.
You know, and but in a lot of your other work, you know, which I've read them all, I have been able to sort of like find that sort of accessible point based off of what I was kind of suggesting earlier, which was it's because I'm suggesting that it's not necessarily a matter of, you know, declaring a war on hysterical realism, but any sort of moment that can't be either justified or that there isn't some sort of background to it. I mean, you know, is this? I'm wondering how much this is a factor in your work.
Well, I think it's really important, hopefully, that the characters are identifiable. And I guess it just feels to me like that is my access point. So it's not like if the characters weren't strange in some way that I would be able to describe them more clearly. It's my way of actually getting to describe them more clearly. So I think it's my hope, and I think it is really true that different stories are going to affect people differently because it's either going to kind of work for them or it's not, which is okay actually with me because it feels like it's sort of a gamble in a certain way to say, well, here's some keys for fingers. My hope is that the way he would struggle with and express what it's like to have keys for fingers would be familiar enough to access the character, or the way to be like, if the librarian is having sex with everyone in the library, the way she's doing that, it's not just the action of doing that, because people could also be like, well, I don't have sex with everyone in the library.
Well, that's though is a very sort of, I think, people could relate to that because it's more tangible. It's within the realm of possibility. What I'm suggesting, I'm suggesting, the daring question I'm putting here,
is
when the reader becomes aware that fiction is a gimmick, that can maybe, do you think that will be a problem because they will suddenly be aware, hey, wait a minute, this guy has keys for fingers, as opposed to just the character just suddenly having sex with someone in a library?
Right.
You know, what do we do to sort of, I mean, how do you struggle to actually not make the reader aware of the of the fact that the boy has keys for fingers?
But I think it's part of my job is to make the reader aware that the boy has keys for fingers. And it's true that we can look at our hands and see that they don't have fingers that are keys, but we have hands. And so I guess it feels to me like it is, I guess it's just playing with the metaphor. And so although we can't identify exactly, I guess maybe there's just some part of me that enjoys wondering, well, what if? It's sort of playing with the big what if.
Yeah.
What if we had a hand of fire? What would happen then? And so it's my way into the character versus if the character had, you know, the regular fingers or whatever. Does that answer it at all?
It sort of does, but okay. I guess, you know, it's sort of like accusations are often like, well, I'm specifically dealing with James Wood, who I'm not entirely, I don't entirely endorse his argument, but I can sort of see his point.
Yeah.
When he says that hysterical realism that runs amok, you know,
is
bad for verisimilitude, is bad for believability, humanity represented in fiction. I mean, you know, but on the other hand, you know, there are entry points here.
Yeah, and I think there are obligations a writer has to try and make it feel real to the reader and to try and ground it and to have it not be just about the writer's own whimsy. So I think it has to go beyond just like, oh, this is fun and I'll just try this. It has to feel like there's something in it that has some depth to it, and the only way to get to it is through this metaphor. And then I feel like, why not? I think there's something that I find emotionally that I can access not just in my own writing, but through other people's art, that if some metaphor is laid really bare, I can access the feeling more easily than if it's not. And so I really look for that. And I think that's why I'll write that way. I think sometimes people will think, well, you're writing that way just because it seems strange and it's strange for strangeness' sake. And it's not. It just doesn't feel like that, because it feels like it's much more about me trying to actually connect with something. And I think some work better than others, which I think, you know, is part of my sort of, you know, let me try this one out. Okay, that one didn't work at all. No one will ever see that one. Okay, and how about this one here?
Well, I guess, well, Let's give you an example of another sort of we had Litquake here not too long ago.
Cool.
And Robert Coover was brought out, and I got the chance to sort of see him. And he read one of his stories from the new collection about an invisible man. At first, you know, you were conscious of the invisible man, but as you listened to the story, you became, much like your prose, it became sort of, you became unaware of this. And I guess when you are constantly sort of in this world of crazed invention and imagination, which is great, what do you have any sort of like safeguards that you employ to sort of, you know, prevent you from running completely off, completely amok? What sort of like when you do another draft of a story, what do you do to sort of get that type of Coover-esque sort of clarity? Which is in your stories too. I just was curious about this.
I think it's, I mean, honestly, I feel like it's more the opposite. I feel so bound to trying to tell things of this world that it almost feels like the more I can push it out there, the more I can almost free associate and say, okay, now in this draft, I want to just have the story go here and see about that for now. And then I can always pull back. I can always ground it more. But to try and stretch it in that way feels really important to me because I feel like my more natural state in writing is to be inhibited as opposed to feel like I'm going to go way out there and it's not going to make any sense. I feel much more worried about it being, it not pushing anything and being kind of a safe story. So I think that the effort to push is to push out of what feels like a more contained space as opposed to feeling like, yeah, I'm going to suddenly not make any sense. I feel so bound to logic. It goes back to logic. I feel so, I think so logically. I think, you know, I'm not mathematically minded, but I like, you know, cause and effect. I like the way narrative progresses. That's sort of, you know, a pleasure for me. So it's much more coming from that place.
So your goal then, basically, when you write, is to play against your instinct to sort of, you know, keep your cards close to your chest.
Yeah.
And but at the same time, it does come out through this sort of the precision that we were talking about in the very beginning.
Exactly. Which is, you know, it ends up being actually kind of an astute way that you circled it around. Smartly done. Because I think that really is right. And it really feels like that's why permission is probably my number one most important thing as a writer, where I look for people who make me give permission as a teacher. I think that's what I want to give my students is a sense of permission, that I feel like grounding it is important, but the freedom to let a story go feels more important to me because the craft part can always be filled in. And in terms of what you can explore, if you're not worrying about that part, it's so exciting.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, the other thing I wanted to ask you about. There's a number of things I wanted to ask you about, but I'll see what I can get in before you have to go. But you also use a lot of run-on sentences in your stories.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering why that is. There's a lot of ants.
There are a lot of ands. It depends on the story. I think Off is a story full of run-ons. And her voice, I think, when I'll kind of write in that character's voice, it's so breathless and so talky. She's really talking to the reader.
Yeah.
And so, and she's a chatty type. She's not a strong silent character.
She was in the first story, too. Yeah.
Yeah. So she, when I'm in that voice, it's really fun because she just wants to talk and talk and talk. And so then there really isn't a lot of space for a period. And I think same with kind of teenagers. Writing about teenagers have that same feeling. And a kind of breathlessness, I guess. So it feels really fun, I think, to let the sentence go like that, roll along.
I had read that you had actually composed a number of font-oriented stories that are... Will we ever see these published or ever see these
they
unleashed?
They were. They were in Ziziva.
Oh, they were? Okay.
Yes. Which... It was maybe a year ago, maybe last September. I can't remember which issue, but I talked about an interview, and actually Howard Junker of Ziziva emailed me and said, hey, can I take a look at those? Which is great because I never thought they'd be published. Oh. And then they were in there, and I got a really nice response, I think, because people felt like it was another permission thing where I think people got a kick out of seeing Helvetica as a dominatrix.
Well, there's also, like, the other thing is there's a strange stigma against fonts, I've noticed.
It's kind of true.
In everyday sort of – like, I'm the kind of person, if I'm in a car – I will, like, look at all the signs on the road, and I will tell you exactly what font they are.
Wow.
It's really disturbing.
I have actually a former student who's a lovely writer who's now obsessed with fonts, and so I should tell him your website, and you guys should talk, because he's doing incredible stuff with fonts that anyway, he's found old ones that have, he's like done all this research. So
I've had friends tell me, shut up, Ed. I don't want to know it's universe condensed.
Exactly. the condensed ones are fun, though.
Yeah, they are very
Sans
fun. They are very fun. Illustrator's great. Okay, I know that you have to get going, but...
Is that cutting it short? Because I can also... Oh. Is that okay?
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, totally,
okay.
Totally.
Okay.
That
went fast.
So, it did, actually. Is there a second novel in the works?
There is. And that's about all I'll say about it.
Okay.
I was writing this other one and I put it aside, so I started a new one. So I have this broken novel that I'm kind of dipping back into and looking at, but I think it's going to be broken at least for a while, maybe forever. And then starting this new one, I'm about a year into it.
And would you say that you're kind of stretching yourself out into this novel, like what we talked about earlier?
I think with novels it always feels like my instinct is to write short, and so with novels what I like and also fight against is just to let the pace slow down and to really build scenes and to really get to know the characters and to see what happens, and that's very exciting, but it's definitely counterintuitive for me.
Well, I know you have to go. Amy Bender, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It was really fun talking to you.